Team Ghost was out there in enemy territory. They could come face to face with this monstrosity. And this time there was nothing she could do but warn them. If she wasn't already too late. "Come on," she said, turning toward the exit. "We have to notify command."
20.
Two elements of a platoon from SEAL Team 3 sat inside the briefing room of the USS George Johnson, listening attentively to General Sousa and his LNO, Lieutenant Festa, discuss their mission, dubbed Operation Renegade. Beckham and Horn watched from the back of the room, their backs to a bulkhead. The eight SEALs sat ramrod straight, faces covered by black paint, only the whites of their eyes showing. Horn, on the other hand, was slouched and staring off into space. Beckham gave him an elbow to the side. That did the trick. Horn sat up straight and folded his arms over his chest.
"The drone we sent over the target shows no recent variant activity," said General Sousa.
Beckham had already studied the maps and satellite imagery, but this new image on the wall-mounted monitor was much more recent. He took in the fiery canopy of trees and the mostly abandoned parking lot outside the Luray Cavern buildings.
"Infrared scans came back negative for human and variant contacts," Sousa added. "However, these scans can be unreliable. Past experience shows variants can mask their heat signatures, and there is evidence to suggest recent human activity in the area."
Lieutenant Festa brought up a picture of two roads leading to the caverns.
"Fresh tracks indicate vehicle movement on both Highway 340 and Cave Hill Road," he said. "If our source is telling the truth, this could be one of the most important missions in figuring out the collaborators' connection to the variants and their attacks on the outposts," Sousa said.
Malcolm Winters, the chief petty officer in charge of the SEAL team, cleared his throat.
"What about other human populations in the area?" he asked. "Any friendlies we should be aware of?"
"This is variant territory, so anyone out there is living off the grid and should be considered hostile until proven otherwise," Sousa replied.
"Roger that," said the chief.
"Any other questions?" Sousa asked.
The SEALs shook their heads.
"Beckham? Horn?"
Sousa looked to the back.
"No, sir," Horn said.
"Not right now, sir," Beckham added.
"Good. Let's get topside. I want to bag and tag these fuckers before sunset."
The SEALs filed out of the room. Beckham and Horn started to follow, but before they left, Sousa called out to them.
"Hold up, Captain," he said.
The general directed his LNO to shut the hatch, indicating whatever he had to say wasn't good. Beckham's thoughts instantly went to Team Ghost.
"We just got word from Dr. Lovato before this briefing," Sousa said.
Beckham's heart flipped. He pictured another raid on Peaks Island sweeping away Kate and Javier and the other kids.
"What's wrong?"
Horn got out before Beckham could respond.
"Nothing's wrong at the outpost. It's what Dr. Lovato found in the lab. She thinks she's figured out what the red webbing is for."
Beckham knew she would come through.
"It's some sort of communication network," Sousa said. "They think the variants are using it to coordinate the attacks by sending signals to the alphas we've seen. If this is true, then maybe the collaborators are tapped into this network too," Beckham said. "It's unclear if humans can tap into this network or if they'd be relying on communication through variants. Either way, we need an immediate answer to this," Sousa said, crossing his arms. "That's why Festa is coming along on this mission."
"Sir," Beckham's words trailed off, realizing he would be out of line to tell the commander of SOCOM that it was a bad idea to send his LNO. Instead, he said,
"Have you heard anything from Team Ghost?"
"Negative. They've been radio silent since the Halo jump," Sousa said.
"Hopefully we'll hear something soon."
"I hope so too, sir."
"I need to get back to command to monitor Operation Shadow," Sousa said. "Good luck out there."
Festa opened the hatch, and Sousa hurried off in the opposite direction. The rest of them took ladders to the deck of the destroyer. The SEALs were finishing up their gear check outside the open troop hold of a V-22 Osprey. Clouds crossed over the morning skyline, blocking the sun. Beckham didn't like going in during daytime, but they didn't have a choice. There was no time to waste. A group of 10 Marines filed out of the hatch in full combat kit, carrying suppressed M4A1 carbines. They loaded straight into the Osprey.
"We got more people joining the party out there?"
Horn wasn't very good at hiding the skepticism in his voice, and Beckham shot him a look.
They're going to help with intel extraction and prisoners, Festa said. And they'll make sure I don't become variant feed.
Beckham cracked an uneasy grin as he grabbed his M4 and Horn picked up his M249. They followed the lieutenant into the troop hold where they took seats and waited for the SEALs. If all went well, the support crew wouldn't have to fire a shot while the SEALs cleaned house. Horn settled into the seat next to Beckham.
Reminds me of the day this all started, riding one of these to San Nicolas Island, he said.
Beckham swallowed and looked down at his boot and blade. The memories brought back physical and emotional pain.
Sorry, boss, I know you remember, Horn said, resting a hand on Beckham's shoulder. We lost a lot of our brothers that day. Hard to fathom what's happened since then. Tell me about it. I think of Sheila every damn day and what could have been. She would be damn proud of how you've raised your girls, Beckham said, looking up. You're a hell of a father. The best.
Horn drew in a breath and forced a smile. The SEALs moved into the hold and sat down. Some of them traded looks with Beckham, but nobody spoke. The V-22's engines growled to life, and the rumble vibrated through the bulkheads. Beckham put on his headset and closed his eyes. The flight would take 3.5 hours, plenty of time to get some desperately needed shut-eye. A nudge to his arm woke him up sometime later. He blinked away his grogginess.
Better wake up, boss, Horn said. Command is reporting contacts in the drop zone.
Horn tapped his headset, and Beckham snapped alert, listening to one of the pilots over the channel.
Please advise, the pilot said.
Stand by for orders, was Chief Winter's reply.
Across the troop hold, Festa was talking on another channel. Beckham could hear what the LNO was saying over the engines. He strained to look out the windows, seeing nothing but clouds.
We're 10 minutes from target, said one of the pilots over the comms. All right, listen up, Festa said. Our drone operators are reporting movement in the area. 2 pickup trucks and a van.
Are they headed to or from the target? Asked Winters.
To the target, Festa said.
If you don't want them to hear us coming, we better put down far outside the DZ, Winters said.
Beckham agreed.
Moving in on foot is risky, but it's your call, Chief, Festa said, looking to Winters.
Why not just land and go in guns blazing? Horn rumbled.
That's not how we do things, Master Sergeant, said the SEAL chief.
He's right, Beckham agreed. We haven't even confirmed their collaborators.
Who the hell else would they be? Horn said. You heard what General Sousa said. Anyone out there has to be treated hostile until proven otherwise.
I'm all for lighting up these bastards if they are collaborators. But I don't want to kill some random stranded survivors, Winter spoke.
Me either, Festa said. Plus, we need the collaborators alive for intel.
The voice of a pilot came back over the open channel.
Sir, we need to make a decision soon.
Let's go low and sweep them, Beckham said. See if we can get them to stop. If they aren't collaborators, they might still have good information for us.
Winters agreed after a short pause.
Let's get it done, Festa said with a nod.
He went up to the cockpit to talk to the pilots while Winters relayed the plan to his team and the Marines. The nervous sounds of pre-combat stretches and gear checks echoed through the space as the craft lowered through the cloudy sky.
I don't like this, boss, Horn said. What if they are collaborators and start shooting?
Then we take them out, Beckham answered.
Horn looked at the M240 near the back of the aircraft.
Target's in sight, said the primary pilot. They're heading north on Cave Hill Road.
The Osprey continued to descend, and the back door opened. A crew chief grabbed the M240 and set it up, manning the weapon.
They spotted us, confirmed one of the pilots. One pickup just veered off onto a dirt road through that forest, but the van and other pickup are still heading north.
Cut them off, Festa replied.
Stranded survivors, my hairy ass,
Horn snorted. The Osprey curved through the sky as it moved to intercept the vehicles. Beckham glimpsed the sea of orange and red leaves in the forest canopy. A brown road curved through it like a polluted river. The crew chief on the M240 aimed the barrel downward, and Horn moved over, tapping him on the shoulder.
Step aside, bub.
The crew chief gave him a glance, but a nod from Festa made him get out of the way, allowing Horn to grab the weapon.
Both vehicles just turned off the road, reported the primary pilot. They're still heading for the target area.
The aircraft turned again, cutting low over the trees. They were close enough Beckham could see the truck and van driving perpendicular to the Osprey. "Fire a warning shot," Festa told Horn. Horn squeezed off a burst in front of the pickup, but instead of stopping, two men stuck rifles out of the windows and opened fire. The M240 barked to life in Horn's grip. As the Osprey curved with the vehicles, Beckham caught a better view of where they were headed. They sped toward a parking lot outside the various buildings once used for cave tours. Beckham figured the collaborators were using them as housing now. Horn fired another burst from the M240. Sparks and smoke exploded from the front of the pickup truck. The vehicle jerked, grinding to a stop from blown tires. The van swerved around, slamming into the ditch.
"Take us down," Festa said over the comm. "Get ready, everyone."
The aircraft's wings tilted up as it slowed, and the Osprey began a vertical descent toward the road. The wheels thumped against the asphalt.
"Go, go, go!" Winters yelled.
The SEALs stormed down the ramp and fanned out with their weapons shouldered. Beckham joined Horn, who was aiming the M240 at the van. As soon as the SEALs were out, the Osprey lifted back into the sky, circling overhead. The SEALs spread into a wide semicircle around the vehicles, and gunfire quickly rang out. Several rounds slammed into the bulkhead, and Beckham ducked down.
"Eat this, assholes!"
Horn yelled as he fired at the vehicles. Beckham straightened to see multiple hostiles had jumped out of the truck and van. The men were clumped around the damaged vehicles, shooting at the SEALs. Gunfire lanced across the road, and Horn rained more rounds down at two men kneeling in the ditch. They both collapsed, blood painting the grass.
"Nice shooting, Bighorn," Beckham said.
The collaborators outnumbered the SEALs, but they were no match for the Warriors, and Horn on the M240. One by one, the bastards hit the dirt.
"Fox One, this is Eagle Eye One, all hostiles down," Winters reported over the comm channel. "Requesting permission to proceed to target."
"Permission granted, Eagle Eye One," Festa replied.
He ordered the pilots to put them back down a safe distance from the vehicles. The wheels touched the pavement again, and this time most of the Marines piled out to help secure the area. The SEALs advanced toward the caverns and the buildings, veering off into two smaller elements to explore both locations. Horn gave up the M240, and the crew chief took over.
"On me," Festa said.
Beckham, Horn, and two Marines walked down the street with the lieutenant after a perimeter had been set up. Within 5 minutes, the entire scene had been locked down. One of the Marines jogged over to Festa.
"9 hostiles dead and 1 alive, sir."
Festa gestured toward the Osprey with a thumb.
"Get the bastard into the troop hold."
The two Marines dragged a man out of the ditch. His pants were stained red from a wound. A cobweb of a beard clung to his grime-covered face, and dreads hung over his shoulders. The collaborator snarled like a variant as the Marines hauled him off. Even from a distance, Beckham could smell the man's fetid odor. Festa motioned for Beckham and Horn to join him and their Marine escort. They set off for the parking lot the SEALs had crossed, toward the entrance of the caves and the buildings surrounding it. The Osprey took off again, pulling away to avoid any potential enemy fire. Beckham kept his rifle cradled, scanning the forest, buildings, and surrounding areas for any hostiles. The crisp autumn air rustled the hair sticking out under his helmet. He filled his lungs as suppressed gunshots sounded in the distance.
"Eagle Eye One engaging 2 hostiles," Winters reported.
Festa balled his fist. Beckham took cover behind an abandoned car with Horn and waited while the SEALs raided the buildings across the parking lot.
"Cleaning house," he thought.
And clean house they did. Winters came back online a moment later.
"Fox One, Eagle Eye One, all hostiles eliminated. We're checking for booby traps."
"Fox One, Eagle Eye Two, we've cleared the building," said the SEAL in charge of the second team.
"It's a freaking gold mine. Better have a look, Fox One."
Festa stood and nodded. The Marines took point, weapons at the ready. They moved into the building and found the room where the SEAL fire team waited. Computers, radio equipment, and crates of supplies were stacked against the walls across from bunk beds.
"Get it all on the Osprey," Festa ordered.
"Guess that prisoner wasn't lying," Horn mumbled.
"Yeah, but how did he know my name?"
Beckham moved to a table with maps to start the search for any connection they had with him or Kate.
"Pack these up,"
Horn said to one of the Marines.
"Fox One, Eagle Eye One, we found some of that red webbing in the caverns.
Winters said. Copy that, Eagle Eye One. I'm on my way, Festa said.
Beckham scanned through the maps and papers as quickly as he could.
Captain, I'd like you to join me, Festa said.
Bighorn, you keep going through these, Beckham said.
What, and let you have all the fun?
Horn snorted.
Y'all got this under control, right?
The Marines nodded.
Come on then, Beckham said.
A SEAL led them out of the building to the entrance of the caverns. They hiked down a stairwell into the underground lair. A brick path led them into a damp, open area with huge stalactites. It took them another 10 minutes to get to the other SEALs.
Should be right up here, said their escort.
Beckham examined the red vines stretching across the walls and hanging from the jagged ceiling. He continued around a corner and spotted Winters and another SEAL with their weapons raised upward.
Look at this shit, Winters called out.
Festa halted in front of Beckham, both of them looking up. Strapped inside the webbing were four variants, their flesh shriveled and eye sockets sunken. Even their sucker lips looked deflated, but their chests slowly expanded and deflated. They were still alive.
What the hell are they doing up there?
Horn asked.
I've never seen anything like this, Winters said in a low voice.
Beckham didn't quite understand it, but maybe this was how the collaborators were communicating with the other locations, through the monsters.
I think I have an idea.
He was cut off by a distant boom. The men all turned back the way they had come.
What the hell was that?
Horn asked.
Eagle Eye Two, this is Eagle Eye One. What's happening up there?
Winters said into his headset.
The van, came the reply. It blew.
Winters, take care of these variants and meet us topside, Festa said.
Winters aimed his suppressed rifle and fired off bursts into the heads of each beast, while Beckham, Horn, and Festa took off with the SEAL that had led them into the cavern. It took them 10 minutes to get back to the road. When they did, they were greeted with billowing smoke and the scent of caustic acid. The scene of chaos seized the breath Beckham held in his lungs. A Marine limped away from the road, his flesh melting off his bones. SEALs ran over to help drag the injured men away from the destroyed vehicle. It hadn't just been packed with explosives. It had contained a major supply of variant acid. The sizzling fluid had hit four Marines. Their skin bubbled and sloughed off their muscles as they writhed on the ground. A SEAL helped pull an unconscious Marine into the grass. When he got there, he suddenly let go of the body and held up his hands, screaming in horror as his gloves melted. Beckham and Horn ran over to help.
We need evac, Lieutenant,
Horn yelled. He bent down with Beckham next to a Marine that had lost his legs in the blast. Beckham immediately tried tourniquets around the shredded stumps of the man's thighs while the injured man mumbled about his mother.
It's okay. We're going to get you out of here, Beckham reassured the unfortunate man.
He looked up for Festa. The lieutenant appeared paralyzed a few feet behind them. Beckham gave the order for evac into his headset, but the pilots wouldn't authorize the landing without Festa.
Snap out of it, Lieutenant. We need your authorization, Beckham shouted.
Horn grabbed Festa by the arm and squeezed. That got his attention. He spoke into the comm, and the Osprey came swooping back down to the ground. SEALs, Marines, and the two crew chiefs helped haul the injured into the troop hold. Others carried equipment and boxes of documents from the building. Beckham and Horn carried the man that had lost his legs. They set him down gently on the deck. The screams of the injured echoed as the door clicked shut. A medic hurried over and set down a pack.
Hold on, brother, Beckham said.
He looked over his shoulder as the medic worked to dress the wounds and improve Beckham's hastily applied measures. At the back of the aircraft, the collaborator rocked back and forth, chained to the bulkhead. The filthy man watched the chaotic scene with a satisfied smile behind his crusty beard. Winters stormed back there and wiped the grin off his face with a punch to the jaw. Then he pulled out his MK3 knife. Horn joined him, rolling up his sleeves on the way.
The son of a bitch had a detonator on him, said the medic. Blew up the van when we went to search it.
Beckham gripped the injured Marine's hand, squeezing and trying to help him stay conscious while the medic worked to stop the bleeding.
Where are the variant leaders hiding? Winters yelled. Tell me their fucking location.
The collaborator spat blood into the SEAL's face and smiled again.
I will tear your fucking eyes from your face,
Winters yelled, angling his knife at one of the man's eyeballs.
The collaborator twisted away, and Horn grabbed his chin to push it back toward the blade.
"Tell us where the variant leaders are," Horn shouted.
Winters pushed the blade against the man's cheek, drawing blood. His eyes flitted from Horn to Winters.
"Captain, can you help me with this?" said the medic.
Beckham helped him wrap a dressing around one of the bloody stumps, but a thud drew his eyes up for a moment. Horn grabbed the guy by the neck, squeezing, and slammed the collaborator's head against the bulkhead again. The man's eyes bulged, and his lips spread to reveal his black teeth. He said something, and Horn loosened his grip. The man coughed, and then looked in Beckham's direction with bloodshot eyes.
"They're everywhere," he yelled. "You can't stop their reckoning."
21.
Dohai took a sip of water and brought up his binos to focus on the condo where Mendez was holed up.
"You see him?"
Rico whispered.
"Negative,"
Dohai said quietly. Two scraggly variants prowled around the abandoned cars in the parking lot, separating them from the building. He saw more moving inside. Dohai was worried they were never going to find Mendez. Not alive, anyway. It had taken them an entire day and night just to get here. They had spent the previous evening inside a bathroom after the juvenile hordes had funneled out of the stadium to feed on the humans that the older variants had brought home for dinner. He had never seen Rico pray before, and he had a feeling Mendez was doing the same thing. The variant activity was worse than a cockroach infestation in the slums, and the presence of juveniles changed the entire game. But at least they had all returned to the stadium for now, leaving only the diseased and starving older monsters out here. Rico signaled for Dohai to advance across the street. He snuck between the cars and behind a bus resting on deflated, rotted-out tires. The entrance to the condo building lay only a few yards away. Beyond the broken doors was a lobby filled with ornate columns and a dried-out fountain. Dohai peered through his optics, glassing the lobby. Two starving variants meandered around a stairwell, but otherwise the coast was clear. Those dying beasts would be no obstacle. He motioned to Rico, and then began creeping toward the condo's entrance, passing several vehicles. A hiss broke the silence. He swiveled to his left, but was already too late. The variant leapt out of a vehicle with a tongue slithering around its sucker lips. Dohai barely dodged the attack and brought his rifle up to parry a set of claws. A pop sounded from above. Blood painted Dohai's face and helmet. He blinked and used a sleeve to wipe the gore off his face as the creature crumpled at his feet. He spotted a rifle barrel sticking out of a condo window on the fifth floor.
"Guess that answers whether Mendez is alive."
Dohai didn't waste a beat. He charged into the condo lobby, taking out the two lethargic variants with single shots. Rico followed him up the stairs, but a pack of emaciated variants came leaping down toward the landing.
"Move," Rico said.
Dohai jumped to the side as she fired two bursts, splattering the wall with gore. Four more variants staggered in the hallway on the fifth floor, moaning like the undead. They could have been mistaken for zombies. Their bodies appeared to be more skeleton than flesh. Dohai took them all down with single shots to the head before they got close enough to swipe with a claw. A door swung open down the hall, and Mendez stepped out, looking at the corpses, and then smiling his handsome grin.
"Took you long enough," he said. "I was starting to think you guys left me for dead."
"Been hell getting here," Rico said, picking up her step as she headed toward him. Dohai sounded relieved when he said,
"Good to see you, brother."
"I don't think you know how good it really is," Mendez said. "Thought I'd never make it out of this shithole."
"Frankly, it's still going to be tough with us three," Dohai said.
"I think I should break radio silence now," Rico said as she grabbed her radio. "See where Alpha Team is."
Dohai nodded.
"I agree.
Don't let me hold you back."
Mendez and Dohai stood guard while she bent down to transmit a message.
"Ghost One, this is Ghost Two," Rico said. "Ghost Three is safe and sound. Over."
The reply came a few beats later.
"Good to hear your voice, Ghost Two,"
Fitz replied over the channel. Rico smiled at his reply.
"Rally point is the Northrop building at the university campus. Meet us."
Fitz paused. A moment later, he added,
Meet us in classroom B2 on the basement level.
Rico glanced at her watch. Copy, Ghost One. On our way. ETA 2 to 3 hours if all goes as planned.
She let out a sigh of relief and patted Dohai on the shoulder. In that moment, he envied what Rico and Fitz had. A relationship they could cling to and find comfort in. Love, in a world filled with horror and loss. But then again, Dohai didn't want the worry of a relationship. He saw how Fitz and Rico loved each other, but he also saw how they worried about one another. The only woman he had ever loved had died during the war 8 years ago, and he had never allowed himself to get close to anyone again, fearing he would lose them too. Another sip of water, a hand signal from Rico, and Dohai went back to business, taking point out of the rear entrance of the building. They crept down the stairs and out into an alley that would take them straight toward the riverside. As soon as he opened the door, Dohai picked up the rotting fruit scent. A platoon-sized group of variants digging through the scattered trash looked up from their search. Each snarled, revealing a mouthful of teeth evolved to shred flesh. Dohai and Rico strode out, unleashing suppressed fire into the ranks of the beasts. Mendez joined the fight on their left flank. Most of the creatures went down easy, but the healthier beasts moved fast. One flung itself up onto the alley wall, then lunged, throwing itself through the air. Dohai caught it in the chest with a burst, killing it before it even landed. The remaining variants scattered, making single shots difficult. Dohai switched to automatic to keep them back. By the time they were dead, he had burned through 2 precious magazines.
"How much ammo you got?" Dohai asked Mendez.
"I only fired the shot that saved your ass."
"Good. We're going to need it," Rico said. The trio set off between rusting vehicles and piles of debris from battle-damaged buildings. They didn't stop until they got to the steel fences of the St. Anthony's Falls Visitor Center. The center overlooked the rumbling falls in the middle of the Mississippi. Mendez and Rico took seats, both covered in sweat. She lifted her binos and scoped the dormant black smokestacks of the University of Minnesota steam plant across the river. After a brief rest, Dohai again moved in front of the group. He traversed a stone arch bridge, leading Mendez and Rico toward the opposite shore. Dark bloodstains covered the bridge halfway across. Crossing here was already dangerous with no cover, and seeing others had died trying made him jumpy. The group ran all the way across and bolted for the shelter of trees in the park on the other side. From there, they cut through the area and used a cover on the side of a rough asphalt road to advance. Distant howls cut through the morning. Dohai balled his hand into a fist, and all 3 of the soldiers crouched down in the swaying grass. He waited there for several minutes, listening to the wind, sensing something out there. But nothing moved. Traipsing around in variant territory had him on edge every second, and his frayed nerves were paying the price. Rising to his feet, Dohai motioned for the team to continue. They jogged to train tracks covered by mud and foliage, until the University of Minnesota campus buildings sprouted into view. Blackened husks of vehicles clotted the streets between the brick-faced buildings. Variants climbed over fallen trees, leaning over the roads. Normally, the limbs might have cracked under the weight of a beast, but not these famished creatures. Their wart-covered faces were sunken around their skulls, and their eyes bulged, scanning frantically across the ruins for food. Through his binos, Dohai spotted more of the thin red spindles stretching out of the debris in the distance. The scree framed the road, some of it scattered over the asphalt. In the center of the street, red vines curved out of an open manhole. If the webbing above ground here was any indication, then he had a feeling they were about to uncover more of what he had seen in the stadium when they went underground. He led the team around several variants fighting over rats. Some had reverted to chomping on their own flesh. The variety of scents helped mask Team Ghost as they made their way toward the rally point with Team Alpha. A variant sat perched in front of the theater like a statue. Dohai considered taking it out, but decided in favor of stealth, heading for the side entrance. He made his way to the loading docks, where 2 semi-trucks were parked. The back doors were open as if someone were still moving cargo in and out of the building. He stopped to listen, and then gestured for the others to join him. They hurried around the trucks, up a ramp, and into the Northrop building. From there, They crossed a storage room full of soggy, collapsed cardboard boxes and wooden crates, nearly devoured by termites. He moved through an open door into a hallway, where his hair stood on end, energy practically radiating off the red webbing growing on the walls. He stepped onto the tissue and continued forward. Skeletal remains hung from the walls. From the looks of it, these animals and humans had been dead for a long time. A quake suddenly vibrated through the building. Dohai shouldered his rifle, ready for something to come charging. But after a few seconds, the quaking stopped. The webbing contracted and relaxed, seemingly beating in concert with his heart. Clicking joints echoed down the corridors, along with the tapping of claws against tile. Intense waves of a fetid odor swarmed into the passage. The sounds faded away, and Dohai signaled for the others to duck low. They found shelter behind a door leading to a dressing area furnished with broken chairs and powder stains. Shattered mirrors lay amid a pile of rotting costumes, webs growing over the once colorful outfits. A few more seconds of silence passed.
"What are we doing?" Mendez asked.
Dohai couldn't explain why he took cover here. Something felt off, and his gut told him to wait. Rico went to move, but Dohai stopped her.
"Hold on," he whispered.
Mendez and Rico both crouched and brought up their rifles, clearly on edge now. They remained there for several minutes, listening. But the beasts remained silent. Dohai finally decided he was being paranoid and went to give the forward signal, when a vicious roar exploded through the corridors. The thunderous voice seemed to rattle through the webbing and right through Dohai, awakening feelings of primal fury and hunger. Adrenaline churned through his blood vessels.
"What is happening to me?"
The roar subsided with the vibrating. Dohai blinked away sweat dripping into his eyes. That ungodly roar must have had something to do with whatever Fitz had discovered down here. Rico gestured for them to advance. They crept past a few corridors filled with sleeping variants, another turn into a wider corridor, and then a final door led them to the rally point. They entered a classroom, where Fitz, Ace, and Lincoln huddled in the darkness. The man all rose, and Fitz strode across the room and wrapped his arms around Rico, pulling her close to his chest. The others greeted each other quietly with smiles. After the short reunion, Fitz signaled he would take point.
"Wait," Dohai whispered. "Do you know about the juveniles?"
Fitz raised a brow.
"What juveniles?"
"We saw them last night at the stadium," Rico whispered. "Hundreds of them."
Lincoln and Ace both stepped closer.
"Hell no," Lincoln muttered. "I don't believe it. No way those diseased fucks are breeding again."
"It's true," Dohai said. "I saw it."
Lincoln shook his head, and Ace did the same.
"You sure?"
Ace asked. Dohai and Rico nodded.
"Do you have footage for command?" Fitz asked eagerly.
"No, we hardly escaped," Rico said.
"But you know they're in the stadium?" Fitz asked.
"Yes," Dohai responded.
"Fuck," Fitz said.
"I think this is worth breaking radio silence for. But first I want to show you guys what we found. Might as well send it to command too."
"What did you find?" Rico asked.
"Something more unbelievable than the juveniles. You'll have to see it for yourself."
He led Team Ghost out of the classroom and up a set of stairs to the main auditorium. The scattering of variant claws came from all directions. Squawks and shrieks filled the performing arts center. Team Ghost crept behind the back row of seats, staying low in the shadows. Webs covered the stage and roped down from the ceiling, stretching from the balconies above them toward a monstrosity on the stage. Holes in the ceiling let the meager moonlight bathe a monster unlike any Dohai had ever seen. Hundreds of vines connected to a bulbous red abomination on the stage. The body looked somewhat humanoid, with limbs as big and wide as a redwood tree. Flesh drooped over its body in huge pink folds, making it look like a gigantic brain. Dohai assumed the creature's real brain was located somewhere in a squat and flat head with unblinking eyes the size of a giant squid's. The creature moved, pulling on the hundreds of red fibers and stretching them like cords.
It let out a long groan while the webbings attached to its chest contracted. The movement caused a chain reaction among the vines stretched out into the auditorium. Variants suddenly burst onto the stage and swarmed the monstrosity's body like worker ants on a queen. They shoved hunks of flesh into the open massive maw with fanged teeth. An old Native American saying came to Dohai's mind. No river can return to its source, yet all rivers must have a beginning. He had found the beginning of this river in the tunnels below Outpost Turkey, and now he saw the source was more terrible than he could have imagined. The abomination seemed to be the ultimate evolution of Alpha Variants, a creature so powerful and strangely intelligent. It had spread itself across the country through the growths of those webs, devouring every living thing in its path.
That's what we came here for, Fitz whispered. We have to get this info back to Command and Dr. Lovato.
Fuck that. I say we kill it,
Ace said quietly.
How are we going to kill that thing?
Lincoln whispered.
It's got a freaking army protecting it.
Dohai agreed with Ace this time, but he knew if they did kill it, there was no way Team Ghost would get out of here alive. A gunshot split the Texas sky, and a variant making a run for the hills hit the dirt in a puff of dust and blood spatter. Fisher lowered his rifle and took in a breath of smoky air.
That's the last one, said Tran.
Fisher scanned the area around the derrick to confirm he was correct, and then motioned for his men to gather around. They had held the beasts back from this derrick, protecting it for the past few hours while the sun rose over the burning Texas oil fields. The exhausted team of 11 men huddled in the dirt like a football team that had just lost a game in overtime. The face of every soldier was covered in streaks of soot and blood from the 10-hour battle. Fisher reached up and wiped his cheek clean, his hand coming back with blood. He wasn't even sure if it was human or monster. The fighting had killed many on both sides. While his men had cleared this area, there were still variants out there threatening the other derricks. He feared his engineers would stop the burning oil only to have the beasts come back at night to attack them again, assuming the engineers would even risk their lives to do that. He no longer blamed his men for fleeing. Fisher scanned the bodies sprawled in the dirt and grass around the derrick they'd saved. Protecting this one had cost them gravely. Amongst the corpses of the beasts were several people that had succumbed to their wounds. Fisher and his men hadn't been able to reach them to provide aid. One of Sergeant Sharp's men lay on his back, his hands still around his neck, where a variant had ripped open his jugular vein. Lifeless eyes stared up at the oily black clouds streaking the light blue sky. Fisher bent down to close his eyelids. He stood and faced the others after letting out a quiet sigh. The fatigued and injured men awaited his orders. The way he saw it, he had two options. Tell them to retreat to the ranch, or continue hunting the beasts. If they chose the latter, they would likely be on their own from here on out. Sergeant Sharp had fought valiantly and impressed Fisher in his commitment to the oil fields, but his request to command for reinforcements had been delayed multiple times, despite losing half his men.
Any word on those reinforcements?
Fisher asked, just to be sure. Sharp frowned.
They said they're working it, but that it's a shit sandwich out there.
Fisher had a feeling that was going to be the response.
We're on our own indeed.
What do we do now, sir? Tran asked.
Fisher took another moment to think before replying.
These attacks aren't random, he said. We've known that for a while now. I thought we killed the Alpha cause of most of our problems, but now I'm certain there are multiple Alphas. We're going to have to kill them all if we want to save Fisher Fields.
None of the men replied, and even Chase, who was normally gung-ho for whatever Fisher suggested, looked at the dirt. The two engineers, armed with weapons instead of tools, both avoided eye contact.
I'll understand if you want to stand down, Fisher said, but I'm going out there to find and kill them. I haven't given my blood, sweat, and tears for this land to let it be taken over by the beasts.
He walked over to the truck, ignoring the hushed conversations behind him. If no one came with him, he wouldn't be surprised, nor would he be mad. These men had already proven their loyalty and bravery by standing with him for the past 10 hours.
I ain't letting my men die in vain, came a voice.
Fisher turned back to the group. Sergeant Sharp stepped forward,
I'll keep fighting, but we're going to have to get dirty if we want to find those alphas.
Several other men exchanged glances. Tran wiped grime off his face with a sleeve.
I'm with you, sir. I got nothing else to lose.
Me too, Chase said.
You're probably going to need our help,
said someone at the back of the group. The two-man team of trackers Fisher had hired also stepped out.
That is as long as you keep paying,
said Eric Welling. He brushed his long hair from his eyes to look at his partner, Aaron Galinsky. The former Israeli military soldier chomped on tobacco. He spat a glob in the dirt.
We'll find the beasts in the tunnels, said Galinsky.
Hell yes, Fisher drawled. He pulled a cigar out of his vest pocket. While he had been saving it for a victory, he decided to go ahead and smoke it, just in case he never returned from the tunnels. He knew the odds of coming back out weren't good.
Grab some food, water, and ammo, Tran said. How about we move out in 15 minutes, sir?
Fisher nodded as he lit the cigar and took a puff. He shed most of his gear into the back of his pickup truck, keeping only his body armor and the vest. Then he stuffed fresh magazines into the slots. He looked back at the bed of the truck for the crate of TNT. He placed a few clusters of sticks into his vest, and Chase did the same.
Here, sir. Better have a drink, Tran said.
He offered a bottle of water, and Fisher downed half of it.
Thanks.
The men loaded up the bodies of the fallen into the back of one of the other trucks. Fisher walked over to help Sharp and two of his soldiers pick up the private with the torn neck. They gently put him into the back of a pickup.
R.I.P., kid, Sharp said.
He crossed his chest and looked up to the sky before heading over to his Humvee. Fisher stayed there a moment, looking down at the young man that had given his life in the fight for the oil fields.
I'm sorry, Fisher whispered.
Sharp patted the side of his Humvee, indicating he was ready to roll.
All right, let's move, Chase yelled.
Welling and Galinsky climbed into their rust-pocked Toyota pickup. The oversized tires kicked up dirt as it peeled away. Fisher followed in his pickup, leaving behind the grisly scene of the battle. He glanced over at Tran, and then back at Chase.
I appreciate you boys sticking with me, he said. I'll make sure you're rewarded for your loyalty.
I appreciate that, sir. But what I really want is a vacation, Tran said with a slight smile.
Chase smirked at the suggestion.
The Caribbean sounds pretty damn nice right about now.
Hell, I'd be happy going anywhere there aren't monsters, Tran said.
Once we get rid of them here, I'll take you boys on a nice trip in a private jet, and we can be on the beach.
I'm assuming this is a BYOB beach, Tran said.
Fisher chuckled.
I almost feel bad for the beasts now, Chase said. Any monster standing between me and an ice-cold beer with sand between my toes is going down faster than a $10 hooker.
Fisher laughed again, but the laughter trailed off faster this time. He gripped the wheel tighter and turned onto another road. The lead truck gunned it toward the livestock barns. The trucks drove past the ranch, and Fisher snuck a glance, almost too scared to look at his house. But it didn't appear to have sustained any damage. He would check on Maddie and the rest of his staff later in the bunker. If they had stayed inside, they would be fine. For that, he was at least thankful. But his prized herds of cattle and other livestock were likely all dead by now. The three trucks parked on the dirt road outside the fenced-off barns. Fisher hopped out and grabbed his rifle from the bed of the pickup. Sharp walked up to the fence, staring at the blood-stained grass on the other side. Not a single animal or human was left inside.
Where did all the bodies go? Tran asked, looking back.
Variants took them all underground, of course, Galinsky said.
Let's go, Fisher said.
He led the way to the open gates and moved toward the first barn. The side door was broken off and laying in the dirt. Chase and Tran shouldered their weapons and slipped inside the dark barn. Fisher went next, using a hand to swat away a swarm of flies. The buzzing sound echoed inside the hot room, and he brought up his bandana to keep out the reek of rotting flesh. It hardly helped. Crimson blots of gore marked the walks, and blood pooled across the dirt. Just like outside, Fisher didn't see a single body. Welling and Galinsky moved ahead of the group toward the tunnel opening at the far side of the room.
They passed several pens, the troughs red with blood and the hay speckled with dried flesh. Galinsky bent down at the edge of the tunnel and spit out another glob of tobacco. Then he looked up and motioned for Fisher. Keeping his bandana over his face, Fisher stepped up to the edge of the tunnel that sloped downward. Red webbing grew on the walls inside, but it was the limbs, hunks of meat, and a full calf stuck to the wall that caused him to rear back.
"What in the holy hell?" said Tran.
Chase bent down, a sleeve covering his face from the smell.
"Jesus Christ," Sharp said.
Fisher looked down at the red sticks of TNT in his vest. His gut told him to just toss them inside and blow the hole. But in his head, he knew the only way to prevent another atrocity like this was to find the Alphas and make them pay.
"Mr. Fisher."
Sharp looked over at him before he tossed a pair of night vision goggles over.
"You're going to need these, sir."
Fisher tightened the bandana around his face, put the goggles over his eyes, and then pulled out his .357, taking a second to look at the barrel. It was time to hunt some monsters. 22. Ringgold had returned to the White House after leaving Peaks Island. For the past day, most of her time had been spent in the PEOC with her staff, monitoring Operation Shadow and the attacks across the country at places like Fisher Fields. There simply weren't enough soldiers or resources to support every request for reinforcements. Those requests were taking up the majority of her attention, since most of the teams in Operation Shadow were still radio silent, including Team Ghost. The only good news so far was from SEAL Team 3. They had just wrapped up their mission in Luray Caverns in Virginia, but even that mission had come at a cost. She took the elevator up from the PEOC to meet with Captain Beckham and Lieutenant Festa for a full briefing on the raid. From the sounds of it, they had a lot of wounded in tow, and a prisoner. Her heart raced to know what else they had found in the caverns. The elevator doors opened, revealing Vice President Lemke waiting in the hallway with his Chief of Staff, Elizabeth Cortez.
"Good morning, Madam President," they both said.
"Walk with me," Ringgold replied. Lemke and Cortez took off on her flanks down the carpeted hallway.
"The Osprey just landed," Lemke said. "All wounded are being treated, but we lost a Marine on the flight and another three back at the target."
The news stabbed at her.
"What else do we know?" she asked.
Lemke shook his head.
"Not much, but Captain Beckham and Lieutenant Festa will be here shortly for a briefing."
Chief of Staff James Soprano marched through an intersection at the end of the hallway at a brisk pace.
"The Situation Room is ready," he said. "Elizabeth, I could use your help with something."
"We'll be there shortly."
Ringgold halted at the row of bulletproof windows framing the hallway. The view revealed the lawns and the Osprey that had landed on the other side of the gardens. A medical team carried the wounded off in stretchers. A pair of Marines hauled off a man in brown clothing, his hands cuffed behind his back. Lemke stepped up for a better look.
"That must be the collaborator," Ringgold said.
"The team also extracted communication equipment and other intel," Lemke pointed out. She followed his finger toward a group of Marines unloading crates from the troop hold.
"Maybe something in there will give us the key to how the collaborators and the variants are connected," Ringgold said.
She turned away from the windows and hurried to the Situation Room, anxious to see what the team had discovered at the caverns. Most of her staff was already at the long table, but Brigadier General Lucas Barnes and National Security Advisor Ben Nelson entered a moment later.
"Any updates from Operation Shadow?" Ringgold asked.
"None of the six teams have reported in yet," Barnes replied. "I'll be frank. I would have expected one of them to have made it out by now."
The door opened again, and a short man in fatigues with puffy, thin hair entered.
"Lieutenant Festa," she said.
"Madam President," he said politely. Beckham and Horn followed him into the room, both of their fatigues soiled in blood. She skipped the formalities and cut right to the chase.
"What happened?" she asked.
Beckham and Horn both looked to Fiesta.
"The collaborators were working with the variants out of the Luray Caverns," he said. "But it wasn't like collaborator dens we've discovered in the past, ma'am."
"I think we finally know what the red webbing is used for, but we need to talk to Kate to confirm it," Beckham said.
His hard features had new creases,
and that made Ringgold worry. "See if you can get her on the line," she said to Soprano. The COS nodded and moved out of the room. "We went through some of the intel on the flight, but the collaborator isn't saying much," Festa said.
"Has he said anything helpful?" Lemke asked.
"Just that the variants are everywhere and something about a reckoning," Festa replied. "Whatever the hell that means."
Beckham cut in. "We know more about the collaborators from the maps and plans we recovered, and it's not good, Madam President."
"They've been planning all of this for a while,"
Horn added. "Planning what, exactly?" Ringgold asked.
"Do you mean the attacks on the outposts?"
From the looks on their faces, she could tell that was not the case.
"Hitting the outposts was just the beginning," Beckham said.
"The van we stopped outside the caverns was packed with explosives and variant acid," Festa said. "We recovered a map that had outpost Norfolk circled."
"That's where my next rally is going to be," Ringgold said.
"Was," replied Beckham. "We're calling it off."
"Holy shit," Barnes said. "You're sure about this?"
Festa nodded again. "Positive, General. The time and date of the rally was found scribbled on a piece of paper taped to that map. This isn't a coincidence." Barnes straightened his collar, clearly nervous.
"Madam President, if this is true, I would highly advise canceling all future campaign events and going underground until we know for sure what the variants and their puppets are planning."
"Absolutely not," Ringgold said.
"I'm not spending my last few months in office by hiding in a bunker. I will never do that again." She thought back to the Raven Rock complex when she was still Secretary of State. There were days she never thought she would see the sun again. No, she would not be going back into a dark bunker to ride out whatever the hell the variants were scheming.
"I will not sit by and watch them destroy everything our administration has worked so hard to rebuild."
"All due respect, Madam President, but they are already destroying it," Barnes said. "We need to consider a new strategy, depending on what the teams find, assuming any of them survive their missions."
Beckham glanced at Ringgold, fear in his gaze.
"I will authorize the use of low-yield nuclear weapons before I let this country fall," she said. "I won't let the variants destroy us again, but I'm not ready to make that call. I want an option B, C, D, E, and so on before nukes."
The room went silent. The fact she had even considered nukes caught everyone off guard, including herself. She took in a breath, realizing her words equated to a knee-jerk reaction.
"If we use nukes, then we are no better than Cornelius," Lemke said. "I will not be party to that. I'm sorry, Madam President. I won't nuke our soil. There has to be a better way."
"I don't know," Barnes chimed in. "I think it might be time to consider making it option A."
"I agree," Festa said. "Especially after what we heard from the collaborator about the variants being everywhere."
"No, but maybe there are more than we thought," Nelson said. "If they've all been tunneling and hiding underground, our counts could be wildly inaccurate. Perhaps it's time to call in help from Europe."
"They're in no position to help," Lemke said. "Half of the continent doesn't even have lights."
The conversation grew more heated, her staff arguing. Even Cortez was red in her freckled face, clearly wanting to interject her opinion. But there was one opinion Ringgold respected more than any. She looked to Beckham, who stood in the back of the room, his prosthetic hand at his side.
"Silence, everyone," Ringgold said firmly. "I want to hear what Captain Beckham has to say."
The sudden summoning might have caught him off guard, but he didn't hesitate stepping up to the table.
"I don't know exactly what's going on, but I don't think we should jump to any conclusions yet," Beckham said. "Let Team Ghost and the other teams do their jobs before we make any rash decisions."
Cortez and Lemke both nodded in agreement.
"What we do know is that red webbing may be part of a biological communication network," Beckham continued. "We have to figure out a way to disrupt it before the next phase, before they use it for something worse."
"Like what?"
Barnes asked.
"I think the variants are preparing a full-out invasion. Those maps had other outposts marked. Every single safe zone was documented in there. They even mapped out routes into our strongholds. To me, that reeks of a plan of attack, something we couldn't have fathomed. And if that's the case, then nukes won't stop them."
A red phone rang next to Barnes. He picked it up and held up a finger.
"Okay," he said. "Thank you, General.
Barnes hung up the phone, his eyes going straight to Ringgold.
Madam President, we just got word from Team Ghost. They discovered something at the University of Minnesota, he said. Some sort of mastermind creature.
Nelson looked at his computer screen.
I've got the footage here.
Me too, Soprano said.
Bring it up on the main screen, Ringgold said, turning around. Horn and Beckham both stood for a better look, but before it came online, Barnes added something he had left out earlier.
Master Sergeant Fitzpatrick said they found something else out there, Madam President.
She narrowed her brows at the general.
What?
Lemke asked. Barnes swallowed before responding.
Juvenile variants.
The footage from Team Ghost had Kate wondering if she was living in a nightmare. It certainly took her mind off Beckham and whether he had returned safely from his mission. But it wasn't just the beast on the monitor. It was the report that the creatures were breeding again. How, she wasn't sure, but she knew Team Ghost wouldn't lie. She took a step closer to the monitor to study the creature they had discovered. Carr and a couple of the lab techs huddled around her, just as transfixed as she was.
You were right, Carr said. There was something else sending signals to the alphas and variants across the webbing network.
Kate could only imagine what General Sousa and President Ringgold were thinking. She was surprised she hadn't gotten a call from them yet.
We have two problems, Kate said. Now that we know the variants are breeding and digging tunnels in select locations, there's no telling how many of them are underground.
Carr nodded, still looking sick, as the video continued playing over the monitor. Variants climbed around the huge beast connected to all the webbing tendrils.
Let's focus on this new monster first and what we know, Kate said. We know that the webbing relays signals much like the nerves in a human's body. Those signals can be passed directly into the alphas with their spindles, and the alphas can, in turn, coordinate with the lesser variants.
It's a complicated hierarchical system, Carr said, just like how a human body functions. The nerves send signals to muscle cells, which then react in kind, propagating signals to other cells and tissues. But in this situation, it's in the variant network.
Kate tapped on the computer monitor.
It's like one monstrous brain, the puppeteer behind all the variant and collaborator attacks.
Carr nodded.
A mastermind. Even the pink folds across the body are reminiscent of a human cortex. Those would dramatically increase the surface area of the monster if it was in fact some kind of central processing node. Maybe this specimen is like an enormous living computer. A monster coordinating attacks across the country with variants and collaborators would definitely need a huge amount of processing power.
If that's the case, then destroying it will disrupt the entire nervous system, Carr said.
Kate nodded. We need to talk to President Ringgold immediately.
She shed her white coat as she headed toward the exit of the lab, hoping to also get word about her husband. Carr tailed her out the door with the techs looking on. They took the stairwell to the command center for the troops stationed on the island. Sergeant Ruckley sat with a group of enlisted men and women around a bank of radio equipment.
Dr. Lovato, Ruckley said, turning on her heels.
I need to get a hold of President Ringgold immediately, Kate said.
Ruckley's brow furrowed.
I can patch you into someone else at the Greenbrier, but Ringgold's likely...
Ringgold. It has to be Ringgold.
The sergeant looked ready to protest again, but she must have recognized the fire in Kate's eyes.
You heard the doctor, Ruckley said. Call the emergency line.
The sergeant handed Kate a handset.
Talk to me, doctor, Ringgold said, preferably with some good news.
Madam President, I'm afraid I don't have any good news. I think this creature is a brain, for lack of a better term, and it's coordinating the attacks across the country.
I had the same thought. And I'm afraid they're planning something even bigger, especially with the discovery of juveniles, Ringgold said, pausing before she added.
I take it you haven't spoken to your husband?
Now Kate was thrown off.
No, why? Is he okay?
Yes, he's fine. But what I'm about to tell you goes no further than this conversation, okay?
Of course, Kate replied. Operation Renegade uncovered intel that leads me to believe the variants may be launching a larger offensive, bigger than anything so far, possibly an all-out invasion. And I have a feeling this monster is going to coordinate it and send out the juvenile hordes.
Kate's stomach dropped. Her thoughts flew to Javier, and Donna, and Beau, and Timothy, and Tasha, and Jenny,
All these people that had just endured hell, only to realize that it might not be long before the world was upended again. Operation Renegade also confirms your theory about the webbing functioning like a communication network, Ringgold said. After this footage from Team Ghost, I'm even more certain that's the case. Kate paused to think, but had no doubt she was relaying accurate information. A few weeks ago, I wouldn't have believed any of this, but... Kate felt the eyes of the men and women in the command center on her, but she kept her focus on the radio equipment and tried to still her breathing. The studies Carr and I have run are pretty conclusive, Kate said. We're dealing with nerve and muscle cells that replicate at rates exceeding the most malignant of cancers. So that's how the webbing grew so fast? Yes. And we also know from our cellular studies, the growth of the webbing consumes energy at an alarming rate. It requires an enormous amount of food matter to fuel the expansion of the network. How much are we talking? I'm not sure, but Team Ghost reported that most of the variants they encountered in Minneapolis appeared to be starving, despite the number of civilians that they kidnapped, Kate said. To be able to keep variants from fresh prey requires a vast amount of control. The webbing and the mastermind must have more power than we could have imagined. In your opinion, if we kill this brain, will it shut down the entire network? Ringgold asked. The president was a smart woman, leaping to a theory that Kate had just formed herself. But she hesitated, considering her response, knowing what she said next could cause or save countless lives. She thought back to the images of the webbing at the stadium in Minneapolis and elsewhere in the country. She had seen so many horrific pictures of humans and animals strung up within the webbing, many of which were still alive. Unfortunately, without biological samples from this mastermind and some live variants to test, I'm not sure. If your theory is correct, destroying the mastermind will be like destroying the head of the snake, Kate said. Cut it off and the variants will lose all coordination and everything attached to the webbing will die. But will it stop the invasion from happening? I believe so, Kate said. There was no hesitation from Ringgold. Then that's what we must do, Doctor. I know this is a long shot, but do you have any recommendations on how to destroy something composed of the tissues you've studied? Again, it's hard for me to say, but burning that thing to the ground is a surefire way of destroying the tissue, Kate said. I wouldn't delay either. We have no idea if it can move or if it has detected Team Ghost's activity in Minneapolis. It may very well be able to use the tunnels to travel. Understood, Ringgold said. We'll need a confirmed kill. In that case, it looks like we've got only one good option. Team Ghost, Kate said. That's right. We'll have bombers on standby. But if this thing is half as powerful as you're telling me, I want hard evidence that we've killed it before we can call this mission a success. And what about the juveniles? Kate asked. Team Ghost reported they could be living in the stadium where they discovered hundreds of human prisoners. There was a pause on the other end. My gut says blow it to hell, but I haven't decided yet. I need to talk to my generals and staff first, and perhaps your husband. Okay, Kate said. I'm sorry I don't have better news.